Good morning, New Mexico. Welcome to the Santa Fe Radio Cafe. My name is Mary Charlotte. We're streaming on the web at ksfr.org, podcasting at santafe.radiocafe.org thanks to Dotfoil Computer Services, and we're at facebook.com/radiocafe. I'm very happy now to welcome Ellen Schrecker. She is a professor of history at Yeshiva University. Her latest book is called The Lost Soul of Higher Education, Corporatization, the Assault on Academic Freedom, and the End of the American University. Welcome to the Radio Cafe.
Thank you very much. It's good to be here.
So, first of all, what do we mean by academic freedom, and what is specific to this line of work, namely academia, that requires that latitude of freedom?
Okay, that's a very good question, and it's one that people don't always understand, because academic freedom is what professors need in order to do their job. What we need is the ability to do our research and our teaching without outsiders coming in and censoring it, without outsiders coming in telling us what we have to look at or what we can't look at. In other words, since we're engaged in the pursuit of truth, or at least an attempt to find some kind of truth in whatever field we're in, we need to have freedom in order to be able to go wherever our research and our desire to disseminate that research will take us. And so when outsiders intervene, whether they're politicians, whether they're other faculty members, whether they're boards of trustees, that is a violation of academic freedom.
What did academic freedom look like during the McCarthy era? This era is one of your areas of expertise.
It is, and academic freedom looked pretty bad during that period. That was a period when sort of national politics emphasized a kind of hunt for communists. I call it the home front in the Cold War, as it were, and it got out of hand, to put it mildly. And during that period, at least 100 college and university teachers lost their jobs for political reasons. Interestingly enough, not because of anything they did in their classrooms, not because of anything they wrote or didn't with regard to their research, but because many of them had once been in or near the Communist Party, and many of them did not want to cooperate with the anti-communist witch hunt that was raging at that moment. And so what we were seeing was a kind of two-stage repression in which people were being called up by congressional committees, and then they were being fired by their universities. And it was a very grim moment in the history of academic freedom, one that really spread a pervasive chill throughout the nation's campuses. People stopped teaching certain authors. People stopped using certain language. People who taught about Russia were very careful in their classes. And it wasn't really until the 1960s that things began to ease up.
Now, in the 1960s, you have professors, in great contrast to the era beforehand, taking stands against the war. You have both professors and students deeply involved in social movements. McCarthy was dead. The kind of nasty reverberations of that era were in people's consciousness. What happened then? Were these students and professors, who admittedly were the minority among all students and professors, but still, were they accepted by the universities where they studied and taught?
What you had in the 1960s, and this is very important to realize, is that universities are not ivory towers, but very much a part of the broader society. They are affected enormously by the broader social movements and events that are taking place, affected enormously by the overall economic situation. And the 1960s was a period, of course, of major social change, especially the civil rights movement in the early part of the decade, really made political activity on campus kind of legitimate. It aroused people, ended that pall of fear that had deformed American higher education during the 1950s, and professors and students especially were energized in ways that they hadn't been for decades. Many of them organized. They organized against the war. They organized teach-ins. As the decade progressed, they became increasingly more radical against the war in Vietnam. And many professors, not by any means a majority, but many professors became more willing to speak out. Some became rather radical, and many of them were fired. But what was interesting here is this is a period when the universities are expanding enormously. New institutions are being founded. Small teachers' colleges are becoming state universities. You're seeing a enormous demand for faculty members and an enormous expansion at every level of higher education, so that although probably, and here we don't really know very much, large numbers of faculty members, especially younger faculty members, were fired for political reasons, they were able to get new jobs because universities were desperate for faculty members. So in my book, I talk about one fairly radical faculty organization that actually in its newsletter decided it would set up a kind of job placement service for faculty members who had been fired. And they had their little banner ad saying, "Come to us for the next job from which you will be fired."
That's quite amazing. We're in such a different situation today. The protests, the social movement, I mean, the era of Martin Luther King and women's rights and so on, had a transformative effect, which you talk about in colleges and universities. For example, there were all sorts of departments set up that had never existed before, like women's studies and black studies and so on. Did those serve to actually transform both the content and the atmosphere on college campuses the way the people who started those movements intended them to?
Not exactly. I think intellectually they're very exciting. Certainly in my own field of American history, there was just a huge expansion of what you could look at, what kinds of things were now legitimate to look at, black history, social history, women's history. And intellectually it was thrilling. And I think people in other fields had the same feeling. In the field of literature, for example, all of a sudden people are looking at new kinds of authors, new kinds of texts. At the same time, in the 60s, many of these demands for the teaching of these new fields really were coming directly from the social movements, from black students who wanted to learn about their own history, from Chicano or Puerto Rican students who wanted to learn about theirs. And they viewed that as kind of a adjunct of their own struggles. Now, that part of these intellectual changes never materialized. Instead, what happened was all of these new fields became what we might call housebroken. They became very academic, you know, which isn't necessarily bad, but it wasn't exactly what I think the earliest pioneers in many of those fields were hoping. It didn't lead to a major transformation of society in the way that the proponents hoped it would. And it didn't change the universities as much as those proponents wanted, or as much as the opponents of these changes were afraid was going to happen.
There were some, I guess they're called culture wars, that resulted, and you talk about the different sides of these things. So, for example, movements of so-called political correctness and all these kind of crazy policies that were put in place in college campuses and the level of what would be considered as sexual harassment brought to levels of detail that seemed kind of crazy on the one side. On the other side, when movements against political correctness succeeded, you also had a rise in horrifying examples of racism and ugly sexist behavior. Talk about both sides of that.
Yeah, I think one of the big changes that the 1960s made was simply bringing in new types of students, bringing in more women, bringing women into the faculty, bringing minority group students into the universities, and places that had been comfortable in a kind of old boy, male, moderately sexist atmosphere now had to adjust, had to welcome these new people. And that's when a number of institutions began to implement these so-called speech codes. And what you got was really a clash of two perfectly desirable goals. One, of course, is the demand for an end to sexist behavior, an end to racist behavior. At the same time, of course, there is the need to maintain academic freedom and free speech. And these two collided in some of these speech codes and were picked up by the media. I think in large part because there was a kind of organized counteroffensive against many of the changes of the 1960s on the part of a number of conservatives, both within the nation's faculties and also outside in think tanks and places where they had been funded by some right-wing foundations. And they picked up on some of the more absurd elements of these speech codes and attempts to crack down on what they believed was sexual harassment in the classroom. You know, you couldn't use certain words or talk about certain things. They were very silly. They overreacted. So you got in the late 1980s and early 90s a kind of moment where there was a sense that the universities had overdone this notion of quote-unquote political correctness and were really cracking down on some basic free speech rights of both a faculty and students. I don't think that's the case anymore. I think that, you know, things have settled down, at least in that regard. But it is important to realize, there's still a few nutty cases, but it's important to realize now that people, especially college administrations, are a little more sensitive to what they're doing. And what you're not seeing is any kind of sort of outrageous indoctrination in the classroom. That really doesn't happen.
We're talking to Ellen Schrecker. She is a historian and author of the new book, The Lost Soul of Higher Education. You mentioned a moment ago the very strong backlash against the students and faculty movements. What did that look like? Who was behind it?
Well, what we have to realize is that the student unrest of the 60s was really very disquieting to a lot of people. Students were rioting. Students were breaking windows. Sometimes they were engaging in arson. They were really, not all of them, of course, but there were incidents on many campuses. And most Americans, by far the overwhelming majority of Americans, thought this was terrible. We have a lot of opinion polls that viewed campus unrest as a serious problem. And so this was occurring at the same time that the business community was experiencing, for the first time since World War II, serious competition from overseas. You know, up until the late 60s, American consumers were not really buying foreign products. That obviously changed. And they are also having to contend with a lot of governmental regulations, environmental regulations, health and safety, and they're beginning to feel a little stressed and very upset about what's going on in college campuses, this kind of revolt against authority. And they believed, a number of them, that universities were at fault, that liberal instructors were creating a kind of anti-business sentiment within the nation's colleges and universities and turning out graduates who were hostile to the business community. And so they began to fund a number of right-wing foundations. And we actually have evidence for this. I know it sounds conspiratorial, but it did happen. They funded a number of right-wing foundations to establish conservative think tanks that would supply a source of alternative expertise to the universities, especially in the area of economics. That's what they really cared about. They also funded individual professors. They subsidized books. And as a result, you began to get out in the public intellectual culture a kind of shift to the right and a creation of this notion that American universities are staffed with crazy tenured radicals who are indoctrinating their students with all kinds of radical ideas about gender relations, about racial issues, about socialism, whatever. And that is something that has continued to this day.
So that brings up some really big and very important questions. If you have right-wing foundations that are endowing chairs so that they can be, so that there can be more conservative faculty, so there's kind of a litmus test for that, that they are funding alternative student papers and then generating a whole new crop of conservative journalists, some of whom are writing today, who are now in their 30s, 40s, and older, because this started in the 1970s.
Yeah.
There are really big questions about truth and integrity here. So, in other words, if the goal of college campuses is the intellectual is a pursuit of truth and intellectual integrity, and there are people saying we have to have right-wing newspapers because it's good for business, not because it's about pursuing truth, that's something that needs to be talked about.
I think so. And I think as well what we saw fairly recently was a campaign on the part of the right-wing activist David Horowitz to try to really get state legislatures to enforce something he called intellectual diversity on their state's campuses. And by that, what he meant was that they should require universities to hire more conservative professors. Now, this is all based on the assumption that liberals in some way are indoctrinating their students and are using their classrooms to push a political agenda, which is not the case. And when Horowitz was asked to give examples of this left-wing indoctrination, he never came up with any. But he keeps on repeating this kind of big lie nonetheless. And it caught on. And as these things do catch on, in part there is some plausibility. It is known that most of the nation's faculty members, or many of the nation's faculty members, especially in the liberal arts, in the humanities and softer social sciences, are predominantly liberal, although the faculties of, say, engineering schools or business schools are not necessarily the case. And what we're seeing is really an assault on the integrity of the university, because what we have and the tenure system, which is something that is also under attack, is that the traditional mechanisms that protect academic freedom are bolstered by tenure and bolstered by a kind of a code of ethics that all professional academics subscribe to, or at least should subscribe to. And they really practice this. This is not something that is ignored, but rather that faculty members watch over each other through the institution of tenure, which does not mean that faculty members have a permanent job for life. That is a misconception. What tenure does is several things. One, it creates a set of procedures so that if a faculty member is charged with, say, indoctrinating his classes or research misconduct or something, some kind of unprofessional behavior, that person will be judged by his or her peers, other faculty members, according to criteria, academic criteria. In other words, is this person still possess the fitness to continue in his or her job? These procedures are designed to ensure that extraneous political considerations don't enter into these kinds of personnel decisions. Mm-hmm. And that's very important. So tenure will protect a faculty member and allow that person the kind of freedom to speak out in the classroom, in the public, as an expert in his or her research. But it doesn't protect this person if he is or she is abusing his students or misusing his classroom or faking his research. So that's very important to realize. Another thing that tenure does, which is not very well known, is it provides a kind of quality control for American higher education. In other words, when you hire somebody for a tenure track position, you go through a very elaborate search procedure that ensures you are your institution is going to hire the most highly qualified person they can find for that particular position. Then, about 6 or 7 years later, there is the tenure review, which is a very, very rigorous assessment of that person's teaching, research, service to the community, and sort of general fitness for his or her position. No other profession has quite that rigorous a kind of quality assessment, and that's what tenure does. It really protects the quality of the faculty in a way that, if you eliminate it, isn't going to happen.
We're talking to Ellen Schrecker. Her book is called The Lost Soul of Higher Education. I want to get back to something you said before, which is that on liberal arts campuses, the faculty tend toward being liberal. And there is something that has always bothered me, which is that people talk about liberal and conservative thinking as if it were sort of two equal, parallel, opposite, sort of two sides of the scale. And when I look at it, especially in the context of what you're talking about in higher education and the backlash against the humanitarian and anti-war values and the social justice values and so on of the 60s, and that backlash coming from institutions like the Business Roundtable and the Chamber of Commerce and so on, you have conservative values at this point being about business and the military, maybe wrapped in the flag and some little bit of family values thrown in. You have liberal values being about humanitarian concerns and awareness of justice and injustice. Those two things aren't parallel at all.
I think that's an interesting point. I'm not sure how they come out in a university setting, actually. You know, because I think what's interesting is that the most dangerous challenge today on the university, on American campuses, to the kinds of values, and not just values, but of the kind of openness that I think humanities and some of the social sciences teach, and the kind of intellectual stretching and thoughtfulness that we want to have our students acquire while they are in college, the biggest threat to that is not really from this sort of conservative backlash, although that's part of it, but it comes from the growing pressure to emphasize vocational education, that students under pressure from their parents because of the accumulating student loan debt, under pressure themselves because of the grim economic situation, are not really thinking about getting themselves a general education. They're thinking about what's going to get me a job. What am I going to be able to do with this education? And we hear it over and over and over again. And what we're seeing, and this is a big part of my book, is a deformation almost, a transformation of the university into an adjunct of the market.
Right.
Universities are becoming economic institutions, and they're losing increasingly that emphasis on non-economic values, on broader human values, on what used to be known as a kind of civic education, the idea that higher education prepares its graduates for participation in the broader world, for participation in politics, but also for a appreciation of the kind of culture they're in, the world they're in, other cultures of the past, that broadens the range of experience these people will come in contact with. And that is slowly giving way to pressures of the market.
Ellen Schrecker is a historian. Her book is called The Lost Soul of Higher Education, Corporatization, the Assault on Academic Freedom, and the End of the American University. This issue of corporatization, which is in the subtitle and which you were talking about before the break, what does it look like? How is this taking hold in colleges and universities?
Universities are becoming more and more like businesses. Now, it has been a very gradual, extraordinarily gradual process that, again, began in the late 60s and early 70s, when that expansion that I had talked about earlier begins to come to an end. And state legislatures, under pressure from taxpayer movements, under pressures from financial crises of all kinds, begin to cut back on their liberal funding of their own institutions of higher education. This is something that happens slowly, but by now, public institutions and the overwhelming majority of American college and university students are being educated at state institutions, not private ones, are now really starved for money. And as this process got underway, they began to look for alternative sources of income. The federal government is now funding a lot of what goes on American campuses. It does it in two ways. One, it funds scientific research primarily through the National Institutes of Health or the National Science Foundation. But it's also giving money not to institutions, which it had done in the 1960s, but to individual students in the form of grants like the Pell Grants and, of course, student loans. And what this meant, when the money is funneled through the students rather than directly to the institutions, is that the institutions then become caught up in a struggle to get as many warm tuition-bearing bodies as they can onto their campuses. And so what got injected into the academic community in the 1970s was this competitive race for enrollment. And what this meant was that institutions began to focus on marketing themselves, on trying to attract students in whatever ways they could, whether it was by building fancy recreation centers, obtaining state-of-the-art computer facilities, gourmet dining halls, building massive football stadiums and hiring well-paid football coaches who usually earn much more than anybody else on the campus, and hiring faculty stars who will raise that institution's ranking within that all-important U.S. News and World Report survey.
Now, you're still talking about state schools as opposed to private colleges.
Private colleges felt the crunch, too, and began to respond in exactly the same way. They began to adapt business-oriented policies. They began to think much more like business people and began to hire more and more administrators who also thought in sort of corporate terms of viewing students as consumers. You also got an expansion of federal regulation that colleges and universities had to obey. This went along with the various forms of funding that the federal government was offering schools, but there were strings attached. And over time, these strings accumulated to such an extent that the former Secretary of Education, Lamar Alexander, used to go around giving talks at various gatherings with a box, several boxes of papers, 5 feet high, that he claimed were simply the regulations governing higher education. It's in fields like disability regulations, there are regulations governing research, there are tax regulations, there are labor regulations. The number and complexity of these regulations has only grown by leaps and bounds. And in order to deal with them, universities had to hire ever more experts, administrators, lawyers in particular, to deal with these things. So that at the moment, many schools' offices of legal counsels really resemble small law firms.
Right. Now, is that one of the reasons why education has become so much more expensive than it was?
Yes, that's certainly part of it. Because what's happened is that universities have been forced, and also once they begin to do this, it kind of snowballs. And at the moment, there are more administrators proportionally within higher education than there are faculty members. I know that's really
crazy.
Disquieting statistic. And it's really something that tells you a great deal about where higher education is going.
Now, let's talk about the actual corporate funding of education and the links. There's a lot of them, for example, in science between private corporate research dollars and academic laboratories, academic research activities. What does that look like?
Okay, this is another piece of this sort of corporatization story, because besides trying to increase the number of students that they can attract, universities have been trying to get corporations to fund ever more of their scientific research. And this has some very disquieting aspects to it. It's particularly in the area, say, of drug company research, in biotechnology, where corporations will make very large grants to academic researchers, but they have strings attached. These researchers cannot, for example, publish their results for a period of time until the corporation has figured out how to patent them in many cases. And of course, for science, it thrives on communication. That's how science advances. And so what this is doing is holding back science, not to mention the careers of the scientists themselves, who need to have publications in order to get jobs and to get promotions and tenure. It's also, of course, very deleterious politically. For example, just recently, thanks to that massive oil spill down in the Gulf of Mexico, BP began making grants to academic scientists to study it. But these grants contained, in many cases, provisions requiring the scientists to refrain from publication for 3 years.
Good heavens. So if they found that certain ways that the oil spill was handled and the oil spill itself were deleterious to 9/10 of the marine life, they would have a gag rule for three years.
Yep. Now, what should happen, of course, is, and did happen at some universities, they simply turned down those grants. They said, look, we're educational institutions, and this is just impossible. But too many schools are too hungry for the money and are willing to sign away their intellectual freedom.
What about the simple issue there's one part where if no saleable product comes from the university's research, what does the company do? But then the other one is, what if results come about that the company doesn't like? So some company is making a cleaning spray that causes you to grow an extra head. They don't like the results. What happens then?
Well, there have been a number of cases. One thing that's true is that these companies are not like the National Science Foundation, simply interested in furthering science. They want to make money. And so if it turns out that the results of the research they sponsor are coming in too slowly because they have a short time span or they're not going to produce something that's really worth marketing, they pull the plug in the middle of the semester, in the middle of an experiment. Goodbye, science. You know, so there's that problem. But even more serious, of course, is the problem of what happens if a researcher discovers something that is unfavorable to the company. And there have been cases like that. Often pressure is put on the institution. The researcher can be fired. That has happened. The researcher can be told not to publish. That has happened. And these are very serious issues that require universities to begin to revise their regulations with regard to corporate funding. And I'm very active in an organization called the American Association of University Professors, or AAUP,
right,
which is the only organization out there that is dedicated to furthering the professional rights of faculty members as faculty members. And we're very concerned about this issue of corporate funding within the academic setting. And we're about to begin a major study of it to see if we can come up with some kinds of guidelines for institutions so that they're not going to sign away their faculty members' intellectual freedom.
The larger issues are about the place of curiosity, truth, community service, and as you said before, just the issues of the things that make life worth living, not just surviving and making a profit, but actually being a citizen in a country, in a state, in a world. And it seems like those values are going by the wayside.
I think they are, but they're not. You know, what's so interesting, just recently, SUNY, the State University of New York at Albany, in its misguided desire to save money, decided to eliminate all its foreign language departments except Spanish.
Oh, my goodness.
Okay. At the same time that it was deciding it was going to expand its offerings in the fields of international studies. Well, how do you do international studies without language?
Right.
I don't know. But anyhow, there was a huge outcry within the academic community, within the university at Albany, and I would be very surprised if there isn't going to be some retraction here. But what enabled this to happen, and this is a serious problem within the academic community today, is that there was very little, if any, genuine faculty consultation when these cuts were made. That the tradition of faculty governance, which also bolsters academic freedom, because faculty members know what other faculty members need in order to do their work, And that has been going as well, because corporate culture, which is increasingly dominating academic administrations, is averse to the kind of wide-ranging democratic and almost, I hate to say participatory, but clearly a culture in which the people who are involved in decision-making are the people who have to live with these decisions, and are also the people who understand what education is about. You know, it's not just dollars and cents. And these people are increasingly being shut out of decision-making by people who feel, administrators who feel that faculty members are too divisive, too slow, too tradition-bound, don't understand bottom-line concerns, things like that. But I think, and here I want to emphasize another problem that I think is every bit as serious as sort of corporate influence on the universities, and that is the fact that most of the people who are doing the teaching, who are handling the instruction in the nation's public and private institutions, are no longer the kinds of people that we associate with faculty members. They are no longer tenured or tenure-track professors, but are part-time instructors, people with short-term contracts, and graduate students. The percentage, and it's quite a horrific statistic, is somewhere between 70 and 75% of all instruction in American institutions of higher learning today is being handled by these people with what we call contingent appointments, part-timers, temporary instructors and graduate students. These contingent employees are handling 75% of all instruction.
You know, and that is a trend that's going on in every sector of society.
Exactly.
We just talked about how that's happening in medicine. It's happening in publishing. You have all these great, amazing senior editors who've been fired, and there's 24-year-olds doing their job in healthcare. It's the same thing. What is it? Why is it everywhere?
Money. It's cheaper. Within the academic community, a part-time adjunct, for example, can earn, I'm not sure what the actual median income is at the moment. A number of organizations are in the middle of a major survey of these people with contingent appointments, so we can find out, because not very much is known about them. But they can earn as little as $1,500 for a course.
Yeah.
And in order to have a living wage, these people are going to have to teach 5, 6, 7 courses a semester. Often an individual school limits the number of courses any one adjunct can teach, so they have to teach on a number of different campuses and become what is known, at least in California, as freeway flyers, people who are going from job to job, overworked, underpaid, and lacking the resources that regular tenure and tenure-track faculty members have. Often they don't have offices. They can't hold office hours. Often they don't have access to computers. Some of them don't have access to libraries. And most seriously, they have no job security. These people can be fired at any time for any reason or for no reason at all. And what that means is that they are very, very vulnerable to student complaints. They have to, and many of them do, sort of pull back, because if they say something controversial in class, say they say something that would offend somebody from a very fundamentalist religious background, they might very well lose their job. And there are several cases the AAUP has looked at in which people with contingent appointments have no protection, none whatsoever, unlike tenured and tenure-track people who at least cannot lose their job without some kind of a hearing. these people are totally defenseless. They're also defenseless if they grade their students too hard. One of the more distressing recent phenomena within the world of higher education is this great emphasis on accountability, on assessment, on making sure that there are some ways to measure, quote-unquote, student progress. And one of the main ways of doing that, and this is being emphasized, it's coming right from the top, from the Obama administration, from the Secretary of Education, Arne Duncan, is an emphasis on graduation rates. Now, it turns out that graduation rates and the reason why students drop out of college is not because they're getting a bad education, but simply because they can't afford it. However, that emphasis on graduation rates sort of trickles down. And obviously, one of the ways that you can pump up your graduation rates is to make sure that students never flunk their courses. And that means lowering the academic standards, the intellectual standards. And there have been cases recently of large numbers, or relatively large numbers, of faculty members, especially adjuncts, who are particularly at risk here, losing their jobs because they insisted on maintaining standards in their classes.
Is there a bright light in any of this?
That's a question I'm often asked. And I wish I could say, oh, sure, you know, we'll get through this somehow. There is, however, one of the things, and I think that's a reason why there is such a crisis at the moment. The American public does care very strongly about higher education. There was a recent poll, I think, in California, which showed that large majority of the population really felt more money should go to higher education, that higher education was something they valued in a very strong way. And what has to be done is, of course, make people realize that you're not going to get more money for higher education unless you shift things around, reallocate money from the military, from prisons, begin to talk about more taxation, especially more equitable taxation, taxing the wealthy, as it were, and that until there's a realization that we've just simply got to provide more money from the public sector to higher education, some of these things aren't going to change. But the public and politicians do value higher education, no question of that. Several years ago, when David Horowitz was peddling his seriously misnamed program called an Academic Bill of Rights, in which he was trying to force public institutions to hire more conservative faculty members, when many faculty members and even college administrations in the states where this was being considered mobilized, went down to or up to their state capitals, lobbied the legislatures, explained how this project was really a vicious attack on academic freedom. And in every instance, once the legislatures and politicians understood what was at stake, Horowitz's measure failed. And so I think there is hope. But that hope depends upon a mobilization, in particular of college faculties. I wrote my book from the faculty perspective in a style that I hope would reach the general public. But I was really hoping to wake up faculty members as well and get them to realize what's at stake and what they're going to have to do. You know, they're going to have to write letters to the editor, they're going to have to start lobbying politicians, they're going to have to become much more outspoken and much more knowledgeable about what's going on their campuses.
Ellen Schrecker is professor of history at Yeshiva University. Her new book is called The Lost Soul of Higher Education, Corporatization, the Assault on Academic Freedom, and the End of the American University. Thank you so much for being with us on the Radio Cafe.
Thank you very much.
You've been listening to the Santa Fe Radio Cafe. My name is Mary Charlotte. We're streaming live on the web at ksfr.org, podcasting at santafe radio cafe.org, thanks to Dot Foil Computer Services. You can subscribe to the show on iTunes. You can find us at facebook.com/radiocafe. And my email address is radiocafe@ksfr.org. Stay tuned for the BBC, then local news by KSFR's award-winning news team, and after that, jazz.